This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
What the pandemic has done has dramatically accelerated something that has been going on for years, where more and more people did want to work at home. It never got above 5%. And then what happened here is that suddenly, thanks to Zoom and other technologies, managers are finding that they actually can manage while people are working at home. Then it's not so terrible.
Human beings are nothing if not innovative. We've invented entire disciplines concerned with design, sustainability, and urban planning. Now, however, a global pandemic is forcing experts in these disciplines to rethink, adapt, and re-innovate. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to design expert and environmental journalist Lloyd Alter about innovation and adaptation in the COVID-19 era. We talk about the hurdles we're collectively facing when it comes to things like skyscrapers, air conditioning, and commuting, things that people, including experts, not too long ago took for granted. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Lloyd Alter. Lloyd teaches sustainable design at Ryerson University's Ryerson School of Interior Design in Ontario, Canada, and he's also the design editor for Tree Hugger. Lloyd, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
A pleasure to be here again.
We're talking under very different circumstances than the last time, but a lot of the issues that you've covered are as relevant as ever. Let's start with air conditioning. You've written about it several times over the last couple of years for Tree Hugger, and now there's new concerns with air conditioning because of coronavirus. We have a system where air conditioning is a reality, but we don't really know how air conditioning is going to either help or hurt our health during this crisis, do we?
Well, no, there are a number of problems. I used to be really against air conditioning on principle because of the amount of energy it used and the way it basically trapped people in their houses. We lost the sociability of going outside or sitting on our front porches. And my thinking evolved as the climate got warmer and people started living closer together and no longer really had front porches. Many of the times they were in apartments with lousy ventilation. And it became obvious that air conditioning has become and is a reality in our culture. So the next best thing to do was to design your houses to minimize the amount of air conditioning you need by building them really well with lots of insulation and shading on the windows to make it as efficient as possible. And one of the ways that in a lot of homes and businesses they made it as efficient as possible is by recirculating the air. In office buildings, maybe 15% of the air that came around was fresh air, and the rest was air that went back, went through filters, and was recirculated. And what we found, what some people are saying and worried about, is that the small droplets that carry the coronavirus can actually be recirculated through the air conditioning systems. And this could be a big problem.
Absolutely. Have we seen any studies of this? I mean, we do know that transmission rates of the virus are much, much higher inside. Does air conditioning play a role in that?
Well, there was a big case of a restaurant where a person in China, where a person from Wuhan was visiting another city and was the first person with the COVID-19 to visit that city. And they went out to dinner in their family. And they had one of those air conditioners high on the wall, the two-piece systems that a lot of people are getting now, where the thing just basically circulates the air through. It doesn't bring in any outside air. And they plotted where all of the virus went, and they could see very clearly that it was being sent through the air conditioner to the tables further to the back. So suddenly everybody realized air conditioning can move it.
Now, when we talk about air conditioning, there's many different variants along the scale. You've written before about having to raise the minimum standards of efficiency when it comes to energy efficient models and newer, cleaner air conditioning units, and also ones that use less damaging refrigerants.
Right.
In addition to saving greenhouse gas emissions levels, do you think that we might be able to also reduce the risk of coronavirus transmission by having better units?
Well, the main thing would be to have better filters, that the filters that most people have in their homes and that most are in the offices don't let a lot of big particles through. And so you've got to get better filters, not right up at what they call the HEPA filter that they use in hospital, but maybe one level below that. The problem is every time you upgrade your filter, it takes more pressure to push the air through it. And so if you just went to your standard residential air conditioner and said, oh, I'm taking out this filter number 7 and I'm sticking in a filter number 12, your air conditioning fan compressor pushing the air around may not be able to push the air through it. And then your machine overworks and it overheats. So the system has to be designed to have fans powerful enough to move the air through that filter. In office buildings, where you've got a lot of people working together, they're talking about going and saying, okay, we're not going to do any more recirculation. You have to dial it up to be 100% fresh air. Well, if you can imagine, if you're in somewhere like Arizona and it's 120 degrees and you've got to take 100% of the air and bring it down to 75 degrees, that's going to take a huge amount of energy. And I doubt that there's an air conditioning unit in all of Arizona that could actually do that. They're all designed on, well, we're recirculating 85% of the air, so we only have to worry about cooling that 15%. 100% fresh air is just going to bust every system in the South, I think.
And that's not even taking into account what you just mentioned about filters, right?
Exactly.
We are in crisis times, and so we have to kind of rethink things, and that's part of what you do, teaching sustainable design.
Right.
This is a form of sustainability, is if we're going to not have millions of people die, we have to adapt, and it's pretty hard to go into a grocery store after we've finally come around to people are in the habit of bringing their grocery bags, their own bags to the store. And now you for the first 3 months, at least in a lot of communities, you couldn't use those. And so the plastic manufacturers are having their day again in the sun. And I bet we're seeing a spike of plastic use, aren't we?
Huge, huge spike in plastic use. They're just happy as can be. You can't get a refillable cup at Starbucks anymore. Everything is going to sort of takeout in plastic. The delivery services are doing takeout in plastic. It's just booming. And more of this is being used all the time, especially with the delivery companies. But if I can do an aside, I did a very interesting experiment the past week. I've been trying to live what I call the 1.5 degree lifestyle, where I use as little energy as possible and I bike everywhere and, I'm careful about what I eat. But on the weekend, I wanted to measure the impact of ordering in food and ordered in my old favorite and thought the plastic was going to be the biggest thing on it, the biggest carbon waste of the whole meal. And in fact, it wasn't. It was the driver. It was having the food delivered, blew everything else away. The plastic was 600 grams of carbon. The driving and delivering it was 2 kilograms. So that's an aside from the issue of air conditioning. Plastic is terrible and we have to use less of it. But certainly under the circumstances of the coronavirus, I can understand why people would be more comfortable with something in plastic than something in a china plate in a restaurant.
Missed the Saturday dance. I heard they crowded the floor. It's awfully different without you.
don't get around much anymore. I thought I'd visit the club. Got as far as the door. I just couldn't bear it without you. I don't get around much anymore. Darling, I guess my mind is more at ease.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Lloyd Alter, who's the design editor for Tree Hugger, and he teaches sustainable design at the Ryerson School of Interior Design in Ontario, Canada. So, Lloyd, let's look at some innovative solutions in terms of design for trying to deliver both preventative and therapeutic medicine when it comes to COVID-19. You wrote a piece about a British architecture firm, Waugh Thistleton, and their proposal regarding mobile vaccine centers. Why don't you explain?
Well, the problem they were worried about, and I know this was an issue with my sister who lives in London, England, Waugh Thistleton is England, is they came back from a trip just when this was becoming and breaking loose for the first time, and they had to go get tested. And they had to go sit in the basement parking garage of the hospital for 3 hours because there was no procedure yet set up for testing where they wouldn't be getting in contact with everybody else. So this temporary facility was set up in the parking garage to test them. The same issue is going to come up if and when a vaccine is developed. You're not going to want to have everybody going into the hospital or into the same clinic or the same place as everywhere else. Everybody else is to get your vaccine. So what they developed, which I think is clever, is a shipping container, basically, where the practitioners inside are all in the proper clothing, but the people come in one end and they go down a tube and go out the other end. It's like nobody's ever going back over the same ground. So that they can set this up, they can bring people through one end, they can give them their vaccination, they can have them sit down for 5 minutes like they always do at the far end, and then push them out the door. A linear process, and they're talking about sort of delivering these trucks with shipping containers on them across the country as a way of not of separating the people from the clinics. I thought it was clever. I'm usually really against shipping containers as a form of building because, you know, they're designed for shipping. They're not designed for people. They're too narrow. But in this use, you want a tunnel. You want people in one end and out the other. So it works very well for that.
And whether we like them or not, they exist in multitudes, and we could standardize how these mobile vaccine centers would operate and be designed, right?
Exactly. You know, basically, there are already doors at one end. They have to chop a door at the other end. They threw in a couple of skylights and line it with an interior finish, and you're done.
So you mentioned how you're trying to reduce your carbon footprint wherever possible, and you bike an awful lot. A lot of people in cities are looking to bike in greater numbers than ever before because of the coronavirus. And
right,
in places with a lot of hills and people who may not want to be biking up big San Francisco hills, let's say, e-bikes are a pretty cool solution. But in the middle of all of this demand for e-bikes and bikes in general, there's some footage that came out of Uber shredding thousands of their Jump e-bikes, their brand that they, I guess, has been absorbed by Lime. Why are they just destroying these perfectly good bikes?
This was an absolute scandal. Last year in France, I used those Jump bikes, and they're beautiful, well-designed bikes. They were really well-built. They were, I thought, one of the nicest e-bikes I'd been on. And you're absolutely right. A lot of people are looking at e-bikes as a way of going longer distances. There's a lot of benefits, not just going longer distances and eating hills up and down, eating hills, but I ride an e-bike all winter in Toronto. Where it gets quite cold. And when I used to just bike in winter, you never knew how to dress, because when you started off, you have the coat on and then you're working and you get worked up and suddenly you're too hot. And then in summer, of course, it's too hot and you start sweating. The beauty of an e-bike is that you dress as if you're going for a walk in the weather of the day. So if it's summer, you dress with light clothes, and if it's winter, you dress with heavy clothes, and you don't have to work so hard, so you don't work up the sweat, and it's much easier, and you can go much longer distances. So there's no question that the popularity of them is absolutely appropriate. The timing, when batteries and motors just got so good, comes with this crisis. So a lot of cities are sort of closing lanes and making safe places for people to ride, which is wonderful. So then comes along this, and Uber had bought Jump, I think, 2 years ago, and wanted to get out of it and made this deal with Lime. And I don't know if it's like who killed the electric car, that old story of how General Motors built that electric car and then crushed them all because they didn't want electric cars to challenge their market for gasoline cars. I don't know if Lime, which makes a really crappy e-bike for their brand, a cheap Chinese e-bike that you wouldn't want to look at twice, wanted to protect their own brand, but I don't think they had a lot of them. Uber just lied. They said, oh, these are old e-bikes. But someone I know sent me all these pictures and say, no, they were these bikes, the Model 5. They're not the absolute latest one, but the latest one's still in beta. It doesn't even work properly. So I don't know the ultimate answer other than it was just a big greedy corporation doing something that maybe it was in their interest. Maybe they didn't even think about it because they're such a big company. But it was a terrible decision. And it's one of the reasons I would never use Uber again.
What would be the possible rationale for it? Not what they said publicly, but can you think internally why it might be cost effective or smart in any way to just destroy this inventory?
The word that they kept saying, it was sort of there were liability issues, which there really aren't. I mean, Houston just opened a whole new bike share system with used bikes that they got from Denver, which closed their bike share system, and they weren't worried about that. I think it's just Lime had their own bikes, and they didn't want to be challenged to deal with this giant fleet of new bikes. What they should have done is donated them to a community bike share or given them to bicycle shops to service and things like that. They all had to have special new chargers and other things to adapt them for consumer use. It would have been some work. Someone would have had to give it a few moments' thought, and I just don't think they gave it the thought, or they just wanted to be rid of them so that Lime could do what it wanted with its own bikes.
At least that's what the people say. If we can't make it through tomorrow, then I make it through today.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Lloyd Alter. He is the design editor for Tree Hugger, and he teaches sustainable design at the Ryerson School of Interior Design in Ontario. So you also wrote a piece recently trying to look at the way our offices will look in the future. I think futurists have kind of had to rethink things a little bit because they may not have considered pandemics and something like COVID-19 in their futuristic thinking. Your piece is entitled, In the Future, the Office Will Be Like a Coffee Shop. I noticed that Starbucks announced that 400 of its stores are closing, which is sounds like a lot, but I think it's less than 2% of their global amount of stores. But it means that there is some kind of contraction in an industry where people
yes.
would just be lounging around in groups. And so much of office dynamics has been, over the last few decades, has been focused on group thinking and group projects. How will our offices reflect this new reality, in your estimation?
This is something I've been thinking about, I will be honest, since 1985, when I read an article in the Harvard Business Review called "Your Office is Where You Are." And the writers were talking about, you know, that mobile phones had just come out. Offices could get these infrared ones, and they were talking about wireless phones soon. And they started saying, what's going to happen to our whole office world when, because the main reason you sat at a desk then was to pick up a phone, when the phone is in your pocket. They were basically saying, your office is where you are. Wherever you are, you can work. So why didn't this happen sooner? Because management was really against it. They really thought, we have to be watching people. We have to be able to talk to people. So they felt it was a matter of losing control. There's been pressure for years for people to say, why can't I just work at home? As computers got smaller and phones got better, about 10 years ago, I updated your office is where you are to say your office is in your pants, basically because your phone can, if you've really work as a complete computer, if you've got the right apps and a portable keyboard or whatever. I've certainly tried to do it. What the pandemic has done has dramatically accelerated something that has been going on for years, where more and more people did want to work at home. It never got above 5%. And then what happened here is that suddenly, thanks to Zoom and other technologies, managers are finding that they actually can manage while people are working at home. Then it's not so terrible. And maybe they don't need to be spending so much money on real estate and dragging everybody's butts through the subway into this space to do this. And they're letting a lot of companies are considering, well, we'll completely work this way from home. But I don't think that's possible. I think you've got to have some kind of office. If somebody's starting fresh and new, how are they going to learn the office culture in any way?
How do you even create an office culture, for that matter?
Yes, if you don't like your wife and your kids and you like to go to the office, that's the best thing that you could do. There was a recent study I saw and wrote about that when they interviewed about 2,000 people, they found that like 70% of them couldn't wait to get back to the office. Although they also all wanted to have the flexibility to work home at some times. The problem with the office in so many ways is that as more and more people wanted to work downtown because all the young people said they did and a lot of them couldn't drive. As offices went downtown, they started getting denser and denser and people closer together. And they said, well, this is how you communicate. This is how everybody works together. And our company was just, Treehugger was just bought by a much bigger company. And I went down to their wonderful offices in Times Square about 2 days before the whole coronavirus shutdown and was amazed how tightly everybody was packed. But I loved the big bowls of jelly beans and the pickup this and the wonderful fully stocked kitchen. Well, you're not going to do that anymore. I think that what we're going to see, people still need to get together. People who are starting in the company still have to go somewhere, as you said, to meet someone and learn a bit of the culture. Some people really don't want to be at home. There will be offices, but there will be more and more flexibility, more people working from home. The office experience when we go back in the fall, when people go back, whenever they do, is just going to be miserable. You know, you've got to go in, you've got to wait for an hour because the elevator rides have to be scheduled. You've got to get up. You've got to sit 6 feet away from everybody with a mask. You can't go into a conference room. You can't get a cup of coffee or the jelly beans. Everybody's going to say, why did I bother? I might as well stay home. Until this virus is completely over, even when people go back, they're going to say, well, where's the culture? I can't even see your lips because of the stupid mask. It's going to be a very, very different experience. And I think most people after a couple of days will say, you know, this was fun. I want to go back home.
And I can't imagine what some of these companies that have invested enormous amounts in creating these campuses, like a Yahoo or a Google, they have a very young tech-savvy employees who are probably very comfortable working at home, I'd imagine. What's going to happen to these vast office spaces, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think they've got all these companies have lots and lots of offices, and there's going to be a rebirth of these suburban campuses because they're all low. You look at Facebook's giant building and that it's two stories and all the workers are on the second floor and then they can go up on the roof. Well, when you've got a two-story building, it's very easy to upgrade the air conditioning. You don't have people going in the elevator. They can take the stairs. And if you've seen that Yahoo Cared Quarters, the stairs are huge because they were designed for people to take them instead of elevators and to talk and to circulate it. The other thing is it's the young people who actually want to go back to the office more than anyone. The older boomers who I've seen, the working boomers and the Gen X people who, they're happy to be home. They know the corporate culture already and they know their jobs and they know what their job security is. So they're the ones who are comfy. It's the kids who want to go back to the office.
Interesting.
Because that's where the fun is. So I'm less worried about the suburban campus type jobs like the Yahoo and the Google. They also have the money to buy the ventilation.
And then by contrast, what about skyscrapers? I can't help but think of Salesforce, this massive building we have in San Francisco. Actually, it's four of them, and they're supposed to be the office spaces of the future. They work within dense living environments and working environments, and as long as there's not a deadly virus, everything's pretty cool. But then when you introduce this coronavirus, all of a sudden, it's a very different calculus, not just for working skyscrapers. We've done pieces on the skyscraper being a possible greenhouse of the future, but we have a lot of these massive buildings that are all probably pretty old air conditioning. And are they just going to lay fallow until this problem is solved?
Salesforce is a really interesting example. It was all designed around the latest management techniques. The whole top floor is, I believe, a wide open restaurant and meeting areas and take in the view. And, there are eating areas and everything on every floor. And it was designed for a particular idea of how people will work together that until this thing is completely beat, and we still don't know if or even when or even if it'll ever be completely beat, these kinds of things are going to be hugely problematic. I mean, you're going to have to make a reservation to go on the elevator so that you're not crowded with somebody else to get to work. You're not going to be able to go up to that 44th floor restaurant at lunch because A, it's closed, and B, you don't want to get back on the elevator. The whole model of the skyscraper is going to be in serious, serious trouble for some time. I certainly wouldn't want to be an owner of one.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, and I always appreciate your time. Lloyd Alter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was a real pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Lettuce, B.B. King, and Eric Clapton. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.